good afternoon, good evening. My name is Marty Plum, and I am your host of A Pen and a Napkin Podcast, a weekly coaching clinic you can carry around with you in your pocket. Welcome back to the coaching staff, episode number 88. And we are here to talk about junk defense, or soft J, yunk defense, with my co-host, Mr. Tony D. Viss. Mr. Viss, how are things with you in the Cedar Valley?
Well, you know, school year will never end, and the weather is pretty good, except it seems like we live in Seattle with all the rain, but, you know, can't complain.
We got blasted with probably a good hour straight worth of rain here today. I haven't asked my neighbor how much rain is in his gauge, but I'm going to guess probably another good inch or so. So I'm asking him right now, if I get a number from him, Tony, I'll let you know.
Put it on. We need an update.
Yeah. Well, I think I told you last week in 14 hours we got 5 inches, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
I don't think we've had any time we've got that much, just kind of an inch or two, maybe three here and there. But we went from a severe drought to really no drought.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and we're flooding and all that other stuff. But nobody wants to hear that. What they want to hear is your knowledge of players with the uniform number 88. And, Tony, I have eight. I think they're all Hall of Famers. At least seven of them are Hall of Famers.
Damn.
And one, I think, will probably be a Hall of Famer at some point. One, two, three, four, five, six wide receivers, a tight end, and a defensive lineman.
Let's start off with Michael Irvin.
That is one.
And I feel like there's a few other Cowboys that wore 88. That's kind of like their big thing.
There is one that did. That's on the list.
Drew Pearson?
Drew Pearson is correct.
Okay. So we got two Cowboys out of the way. Two of our, do you say six wide receivers?
Yes.
I'm trying to remember if it was Torrey Holt or Isaac Bruce that wore it for the Rams.
Which one do you want to pick?
Let's go with Torrey.
Good guess. That is three. You are three for three.
Okay. Let's see if we can keep her rolling here.
I've got a Viking, a Steeler, and a Colt.
Crap. I want to say Chris Carter, but I think that is... I don't think Chris Carter was 88, was he?
As... Regis Philbin would say, is that your final answer?
Let's go with it.
Good thing you did. It is correct.
All right, let's go. Was Marvin Harrison, was he 88 for the Colts?
He was. You are five for five. You are, as they say, en fuego.
So we've done the Ram, we've done the Colt. What was the other one?
Steeler.
Johnny Stallworth?
Nope.
Lynn Swann,
yep.
And then we need a lineman and a tight end.
Defensive lineman and a tight end.
Okay. Tight end.
A tight end from this team was on last week's. Same franchise. Hall of Famer.
Tight end from this week was on last week.
He tried to shake it off, but he had a little bit of a blank space.
So I'm guessing we're going, because it was, let's go Tony Gonzalez.
That is correct.
And then our defensive lineman that was 88.
Yes. If you were to look at him, you would maybe say he had, you know, one eye and one horn and could fly.
An eye, a horn, and can fly.
Yes. One eye, maybe one horn, cycle. Could fly.
Not Alan Page.
Is that your final answer?
Let's go with Alan Page.
He's a one-eyed, one-horned, flying purple people eater.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there it is. That was a pretty good hint.
That was a really good hint.
Yeah.
If you had said a judge, because didn't he become a judge?
Yeah, a Supreme Court judge in the state of Minnesota, I think. Something like that.
It's not bad.
Yeah, it's all right. It's not quite a public school social studies teacher, but, you know, it's good.
He can make a living that way.
Make a living. So, we are here, episode number 88, to talk a little junk defense. Great topic picked out by Tony. I think it's a great one here to discuss. I think it's something that you look at in your off season. I'll get the party started here a little bit on this one here, Tony, if you don't mind. Yeah. I've always believed, and I've never been, I know there's differing philosophies out there, but for me, and I can only speak for me, I've always believed that you cannot just be a one defense team. Hey, we just run all man-to-man, and that's what we do, and blah, blah, blah. Or we run 2-3 zone, and that's all we do, blah, blah, blah. I've just never believed that. Again, that's just a matter of philosophy. Now, do I believe in having 10, 12 different defenses for in the half court or even in the full court? Definitely as my career evolved, absolutely not. But I do believe that you need to have a man defense that you can run, and I think you base all of your stuff off of your man principles. One man, one zone, and one junk defense that you could throw at an opponent. And I think you get really good. Now, if you get, and I've always said, if you get past plan A, you need to have a plan B. If you need to get past plan B, you need to have a plan C. If you're getting past plan C, you're probably in trouble anyway, and the game's out of your grasp. But I really believe that it is important that you do have a junk defense in your repertoire, that it is something that you can go to. Do you have to be great at it? No, because I think sometimes if you run junk even decently, because it is a junk defense, people can tend to struggle with it. They tend to get stagnant against it because they're not used to seeing it, especially there are certain teams that are used to seeing it. You know, Iowa, let's say, would see junk. Or we had a kid here in Nebraska. Her and her mom were on the podcast before the season started, Britt Prince, and they saw every sort of junk defense possible over the span of her high school career. So some teams are more used to it than others, but a lot of teams are not used to seeing junk. And so I think it's important that you do have it in your repertoire. So that's my opening salvo here on my philosophy on junk defense, Tony.
I agree with you 100%. I think you have to have junk every once in a while. Kind of go back and maybe give a little bit of an analogy of what you're talking about. To me, it'd be like if I was just a fastball pitcher. At 100-mile-an-hour fastball, I mean, that's obviously impressive. Mm-hmm. But if all I ever threw was 100-mile-an-hour fastball, hitters are going to tie me up eventually and hit me. And so I have to have something else out there. You know, you can have like your man that you do like little different things. Like we obviously are known as a switching team, but you can hard hedge and fight through and do some things out of your man that way to give them a different look, if you will. Zone wise, you can have your even front zone. You can have your odd front zone. And then junk wise, there's so many different junk defenses that are out there. In my time in Harlan, I would describe Mitch Osborne as the master of the junk defense. Mm-hmm. I thought I knew, you know, triangle and two and box and one and diamond and one and blah, blah, blah. And the next thing you know, you're out there. It's 1-3 with a chaser. It's an inverted triangle and two. And it's nuts. And, you know, kind of like what you're talking about a lot. There are teams that see it. Like if you're Iowa, you have to be aware of it when you with Caitlin Clark and like the Prince girl that you mentioned earlier, for, you know, in your state, you have to be ready for that stuff. But not many teams have a junk offense, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And due to that fact, if you give them and you vary your looks at them, you can really mess some teams up. And, you know, we've done things where sometimes we just won't guard kids. Mm-hmm. And it really messes with them. Like you have a wide open 15-foot jump shot, knock yourself out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if they hit one, we kind of, depending, you know, might be a little bit excited about it because if they're not a great shooter, now they've hit one, now they think they're a shooter and they're taking more shots than what they normally do. And then the next thing you know, you're 1-for-4, 1-for-5, and you begin to panic. And the worst thing you can do when you panic is just keep shooting it more. And so there's all kinds of mental sides of it as well as the strategic side of it. But yeah, I really am a big fan of junk defense. When I was out in Harlan and, you know, kind of sitting there and watching Mitch do it, probably fell in love with it too much. But at the same time, you know, you can, I think if you can play man, you can play any type of other defense as well, depending upon your rotations and adjustments and such. But yeah, I'm a big fan of it.
I believe it was Jim Weeks here in Nebraska that said something, and he's probably not the first nor the last to say it. And so I'll give Jim credit for it. Sometimes to guard is to not to guard. And so the best thing is, hey, the Vis kid, let him shoot. And even if he hits one, who cares? You know, if he hits three or four, then we'll evolve and then we'll do things. I distinctly remember we played a rival and we kind of had the, you know, kind of the, we called it the dork rule. Hey, we're going to leave this gal open. And of course, that's the night that she hits like 4 15 footers after we said, hey, we're just going to let her shoot. And if she shoots, if she makes it, we deal with it, you know. And sometimes it backfires on you. But you know, you can have junk within even, let's say, your man-to-man principles as well, Tony, don't you? You know, I, like, for example, we called it, at one point we called it Nelson, Nelsoning somebody in our man-to-man, which meant full deny. And I actually saw one time Mitch's Harlan played Scud a couple of times when I was at Scud, and Mitch's team did that to us. They just full fronted, full denied our best shooter, wouldn't let him get the ball, and they ended up, you know, Harlan ends up winning the game by 10, 12 points. We named it the Nelson defense because we played against this gal from Gross Catholic long time ago, my first year as head coach at Scud. Her name was Renee Nelson, and we played her in the conference third place game, and she went off for like 37 or 39 on us, and we played terrible. We just said, hey, we play her again, and they were in our district that year. We're not letting her beat us, and we just call it, hey, we're just going to Nelson her. And for years and years and years, we just called it Nelson. When I was at Fort Calhoun, we called it Kawhi, just to kind of put a little bit more different, because those kids, you know, they didn't understand it, so I changed it, but the concept was the same. So, you know, I think that's, you made up, or you had a lot of good points there, Tony. When should you use junk defense? How often do you use junk defense in your estimation? What's a good steady diet, both that's good for your team and good for scouting purposes and all the things that you have to consider when it comes to junk defense?
There's a lot of things to consider. You know, I would sit there and I would watch Mitch during the regular season, and he would junk on occasion, and you just knew he was saving it for the postseason in the right time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, once he got in the postseason, it was almost a different junk defense every single game.
Yeah.
And, you know, and they would be working on it in practice and stuff, saving it for the right time. And, you know, whether that's in Nebraska, you know, where they're not going to probably get scouted, you're not going to see too many teams from Iowa traveling and watch that game for him, but he would break it out at the right time and just was a master of knowing when. And, you know, I would suggest that's a big part of it, is just knowing the when. And I wouldn't play it a lot, you know, during the regular season. Maybe a big game where it's a conference championship at stake, or, you know, you're trying to play for a number one seed in the tournament, you know, or whatever, but I would hang on to it for the right time. And that right time might be the sub-state game or the first round of state semifinal, whatever. But I don't know if I would show it a ton, but I would be showing it here and there and be working on it in practice. So when it was time to break it out, that, you know, you were familiar with what you were doing with your rotations and your strategy and stuff, you know. And like you said, Marty, there are things you can do in the man. Like we would call black ball screens. Anytime team was at a ball screen, we'd black it and we trap it and we get out in passing lanes and get into rotation out of it. Or we would fire in the post. When you throw it in the post, we're going to double team you. Mm-hmm. And so we would have those things, but it depended upon the team too. Like for the most part, I don't see a ton of great post players at the sophomore level. We did see one last year and we broke it out, but we hadn't worked on it a ton, and it wasn't overly effective for us. And then when we blacked some ball screens, we tried it against an opponent that we thought that it would work well against. And all of a sudden, when we were trying to save it for a particular opponent, that opponent came out, and because they played at a much faster speed than the other opponent, we had some troubles in our rotation when we would black the ball screen. So, you know, it's tricky. There's a balance there, and you know, it takes, I guess, there's a science to it, but there's also an art to it as well, knowing when and the opponent to do it. But I don't think I would run it more than a handful of times.
Yeah, it's a fine line, because you don't want to go into, let's say, that sub-state game and have it be the first time that you've ran your junk. But you also don't want to show it so much that Cedar Rapids Prairie knows there's a good chance you could run your inverted triangle and two at you that night as well. So, you kind of want to keep it in your hip pocket, but you also don't want it to be the first time that you've ever ran it. And I think that's, like you were talking about, Tony, that's the art of it. That's kind of what you're referring to there.
Mm-hmm. And the thing that would always crack me up, you know, like I said, Mitch would run it once or twice the entire season, you know, during the regular season. And then he would be saving it for an opponent. And he ran it against this opponent, Marty, I swear, almost every single postseason. And the other coach would actually never saw it before. Mm-hmm. And it would just crack me up, because they would score like, you know, 60-some a game. And then here comes Harlan. They're in the 30s and the 40s. And Mitch ends up beating them. And I don't know if I would say Harlan had the better talent the majority of those times that they beat them. I mean, it's just, it's crazy. But yeah, there's the science as far as, hey, they got this stud, or they've really run a great man offense, or whatever the case may be. There's the science, the strategy behind it, and then there's the art of when. You know, it's kind of like cards, if you will. Uh-huh. I mean, you have to play the right card at the right time to set things up. And so it's the art of, you know, I would consider Mitch, to be honest with you, a superior poker player.
Coaches, it is official. October 12th and 13th, Saturday and Sunday, October 12th and 13th, 2024, will be our first annual A Pen and a Napkin Coaches Retreat. It is going to be over 24 hours of just basketball coaching and getting yourself primed and ready for the upcoming season. We're going to do a lot of different things. Coach Flannery and the staff at Creighton University have been gracious enough to allow us to come in and watch them practice that day. We're going to have roundtable sessions with coaches that you're attending the clinic with, which is one of the best aspects of any A Pen and a Napkin event. We're going to have a full timeout situation score group discussion with the coaches that are attending, as well as coaches social, and then, of course, guest speakers. We got some great coaches lined up right now. We're probably going to be adding a couple of more here. It is going to be a great, great weekend here in Omaha. We'll be staying at the Holiday Inn Express at 87th and West Dodge Road here in Omaha, and it is really, really affordable. $200 for the weekend, and that includes food, that includes your lodging at the hotel, drinks, everything that goes into it. It is going to be included in that $200 for well over 24 hours worth of activities. If you're a commuter, if you're living in the Omaha area and you want to join in, but you don't want to stay at the hotel, it's $125. Think of that. That's literally what, $5-6 an hour for an entire weekend of becoming a better coach. So coaches, I encourage you to sign up as soon as you can for the first annual A Pen and a Napkin Fall Coaches Retreat. Tony, how are ways that you have communicated putting in the junk defense in the sense of, hey, we're usually a man-to-man team. Our man-to-man defense, we called it red. Hey, mm-hmm. Usually we're in red, and the junk D that we used the vast majority of the time was a triangle and two, and we called it Blue Jay. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you why we just did. You know, hey, we're red, blah, blah, blah. Our zone was blue. But now, hey, tonight, you know, we're gonna be ready to run our Blue Jay here. And I think you have to have a viable way to communicate especially if you've got a good team, if you've got kids with high basketball IQ, a lot of times the first question you're going to get, of course, is why? Why are we going away from something that has been successful for us, whether it's our base man or our base zone, with the subtle tweaks that you make based on scouting reports? Now we're kind of really going in a different direction here. So why, coach, why are we doing this? And I think that's a really, really important part of an effective junk defense, is having your players understanding the why as to why you are doing it. Don't you think?
100%. And I think that's more, and I'm not trying to sound like that crotchety old man, get off my lawn type thing.
Well, you always sound like that, but that's okay.
It's true.
Yeah.
And I think that's
you
even
whippersnappers
with today's generation, is they want to know why, not just the why behind a junk defense, but why are we doing this drill in practice? And, you know, they have that curiosity of the why. And I think part of it is going back to where we kind of started earlier. You know, you explain the strategy behind it, you know, and then I would get into, you know, for our guys, Kennedy's has a good baseball program, and I have a lot of guys that play baseball, and they kind of get, you know, hey, if your opposing team or your pitcher has just a fastball, you know, they might be good that first time through the order. But we all know people get tired and the fastball slows down, and batters, if they know what's coming, they're going to speed that swing up. And you can talk about cards and different things like that with them. But I think you owe them that explanation, you know, behind it. And I think that's something that as a coach that you have to be able to explain to them. And the other thing to tell them, you know, hey, we're going to be in it and we're going to give it a chance. But trust me, after giving it a chance, if it's not working, we'll go back to what's, you know, the one that's brought us there, that old adage, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, you know. Mm. But at the same time, I just think as a coach, this gives us the best opportunity to win.
Yeah. And I think you're also honest of, hey, we're going to work on Blue Jay, but we're going to have it ready, but we may not use it, you know, and especially in the regular season, you're getting ready to play, you know, Cedar Rapids, Washington, and big game, let's say. But, you know, you're 10-0, they're 9-1, and yeah, you want to win the game, but you also see it like, you know, if we can, we have it if we need it to win the game, but boy, I'd really rather not use it if I don't have to, but I will if we need to. And I think those conversations need to be had as well. And I also think it's really important when you're talking about that. And I know this was really important for us. When we worked on our junk stuff, we still had a lot of the same defensive principles that we used in our man and zone. So like for us, when we were on the ball, everything we did was forcing baseline, sideline. Well, if in the triangle and two, let's say, if your player caught it, we always push baseline, sideline as well. You know, we didn't want it to, we knew it, we were taking a chance with how we were running it, that it could be confusing as it is. So we didn't want to make it too confusing to where, okay, not only are we kind of throwing this different look for us as well, but here's this different rule that you do differently. And I think that as you implement your junk defense, that you try to keep as much of the base principles of the junk defense to your base principles of your base man and your base zone as well. That's something I thought of as well, or that's something that I considered when we were teaching it, Tony. I don't know if you think the same, if you think differently, where are you at with that?
You know, I think it's one of those things where you want to try to keep as much the same as you can, but at the same time, you know, as you take a look at if you're a man team and you're running one three with a chaser or, you know, inverted triangle and two, you have to really highlight the differences in the rules in there. But at this, you know, there are those things where you can hit that overlap and reinforce that. Hey, this is stuff we've already been doing. We're okay here. And then when it's different enough, you really got to make sure you break it down and work on that with them. But yeah, I mean, it's just one of those things. It's a process, and as you take a look at it, you know, you have your scout group, you work through it, you do all those things, and hopefully when everything comes out in the end, you come out smelling like a rose. But sometimes, as a mad scientist, if you will, it can blow up in your face.
Mm-hmm. What else you got on junk defenses, Tony? I got a couple more things, but I kind of want to play. I don't want to sound like Jigsaw here. Let's play a game. But I got a couple of games for us here, Tony, to play. So when it comes to junk defense, but do you have anything else on junk defenses?
Yeah, you know, the thing it would give you with junk defenses, it kind of depends upon how complex you want to get. You know, there's junk defenses, which are the traditional, you know, everybody knows the box and one, all right? Triangle and two is pretty basic as well. And then you have that next tier of stuff that you get into with junk defense, where 1-3 with a chaser is a little bit more unique. It's not something that a lot of teams have in their back pocket that they run and that they do. Inverted triangle and two is always interesting because when the ball is above the free throw, you're in a regular triangle and two look. When the ball goes below the free throw, now you just have one player at the top, the free throw, top of the key area, and the other two players are now in the block area. And so it just is an adjustable, inverted, whatever term you want to throw there. And then I've seen others that have been kind of weird too. I've never tried these. I don't think I'm smart enough to do it as a coach. But I've seen some teams that if the team comes down and say they attack on the right side of the floor, the team's man. Yep. And then if they reverse the ball to the left side of the floor, they all of a sudden hop into a zone. And, you know, and so there's different layers and different levels to it. But yeah, it's I don't know. It's just junk intrigues me just because of how different it is. And it keeps teams off balance. But the one thing you have to be careful, this is kind of what I was going through, the different layers with the complexities of it, is you don't want to trick your own team. Because if you put your team out there and they can't run any of it, you know, it's one of those things where if your kids can't get what you're trying to put down, you can't do that. As a coach, you have to be able to coach your players where they are.
Yep. All right. You ready for the first game, Tony?
Let's fire away.
All right. Name as many junk defenses as we can here, and we'll go back and forth here. All right?
Ooh, okay.
Okay. So, I had triangle and two.
Okay. I'll go with diamond and one.
Box and one.
I don't know if you want to call it adjustable, inverted, whatever you want to call it, was kind of the one I was describing earlier with the triangle and two, where if the ball is above free throw, you're in a, you know, a triangle, that triangle look, and if the ball goes below the free throw, now you have two players in the block and one up top, so the adjustable, if you will.
Mm-hmm. The aforementioned full deny, where you, the Nelson or the Kawhi.
Okay. 1-3 with a chaser.
We're tied. I don't have anything else.
I would also go with the combo, man on one side, zone on the other side.
Okay. I didn't have that written down earlier, so I guess you're the winner. You're the winner of the game, Tony.
Woo! Yeah. First time I've won in a while.
Look at you, superstar.
Yeah, it's my night. I'm off to the casino.
Don't you spend it all in one place there.
You know I will.
Talk about a game, Tony, where you implemented a junk defense and it really paid off for you. And how did it pay off for you?
When I was in Harlan my first year, we were the 2 seed in our region. And Denison, our neighbor to the north, they're about 25 miles away. They were the 1 seed. They had ended up getting knocked off by Sioux City Heelan. Sioux City Heelan had a guard by the name of Michelle Lund.
Oh, she was really good. Yeah.
Really, really good player. And they didn't have a lot around her, so we went 1-3 with the chaser. And kind of our thing with 1-3 with the chaser is we would take out of our 5 starters, maybe not our best defensive player, and put her on the one. The best player, and just like what you're talking about, Nelson face guard, don't let her touch it. You know, we would run another defender at her to make her give the ball up, and then once she gave it up, deny it, don't let her get it back. And we rocked Sioux City Heelan's world. We blew them out. I think we only turned the ball over 3 times, beat them by 20 some points. And then the next year, they ended up with the niggling girl and Carly Tritz, who ended up at Creighton. Didn't have a bad career.
Carl's anyway. Was all right, yeah.
and took us to the woodshed in return. But the year that they just had one, we were right there.
We had a game. This was, as Forrest Gump would say, this was a long time ago. But we played Roncalli. We had lost to Roncalli three times in a row. And we were just really, really frustrated. And we needed to come up with something. They had three really, really good players. And they had these two really strong six-foot post players. And what I came up with, and this wasn't on my list of possible defenses because I kind of wanted it to wait. So I could have tied it, I guess, Tony, or whatever. But
I think I know what you're talking about because we've run this one too.
Yeah. We manned up on the three good players, and we zoned up with the other two players. And
kind of like a stack and a three-on-two?
Yeah.
With those, yeah.
Yeah, yep. And I came up with it. And I'm, again, people have done it before me. People had done it after me. But it was the first time that I had ever thought of it. And I came up with it about 2 o'clock in the morning. And I was like, that might work. But we always had the concern because one of their kids was kind of an inside out type of player, kind of a 3.5. And, you know, she was always a tough matchup for us. They had a really good point guard. They had a true two guard, but then they had this, like I said, this 3.5 that could go inside, that could go outside. And she was the one that gave us the biggest fits. And so I had my point guard, and I was really fortunate. I had 2 6-1 girls that were really physical, and we had them kind of alternate at that other stack part of it. Mm-hmm. And we just said, hey, just don't let the other two kids shoot layups. And we kind of had to, the 6-footer for us really had to battle those 2 6-foot kids for rebounds for Roncalli. And they weren't really sure what to do with it, because, you know, it was a weird lineup. It was a weird thing, and you could just see them trying to figure it out. And plus we had kids in the lane to cut off the lane if they tried to dribble penetrate. You know, and I had a really deep team, so we rotated 8 or 9 kids in and out of the game, and they really only had 5, 5.5 players. We were able to wear them down as the game went on, and we ended up winning. We ended up winning the district semifinal by 17 or 18, and then we beat South Sioux the next night to go to the state tournament, and that was a really big deal, you know. And a lot of people, when I was during that time, they remember the South Sioux game because, hey, it was beating South Sioux to go to the state tournament, and Kelly was in the middle of his run and all that other stuff. But I always pointed at that Roncalli game the night before, like that was the big one that we had to win, just to give ourselves a chance. And so I was really proud of the kids that night. So they did a great job of doing what we asked them to do. So when's a time where the junk defense has cost you a game, Tony?
You know, and a part of like what we're talking about here with the junk defense, you know, we mentioned earlier that if your players can't do it, or the other part of it is if they don't buy into it. And we tried to run the defense that you were talking about, where we would man up on three players that were really good athletes, you know, and could drive it, could shoot it. And then they had two other kids that, you know, or more like mid-range type, but they didn't really have a back-to-the-basket post kid. So we had two kids, one at the top, you know, free throw area, top of the key, the other one in the paint, and they were to help if the kids tried to drive and different things like that. And our kids just not buy into it. Because they didn't buy into it, we got lit up and then had to get out of it and go man. And when we went man, they believed in that, and we were able to make a little bit of a comeback in our man-to-man. And you know, the thing was at the beginning was if we hadn't gone junk right away, you know, that maybe we would have won that game. Mm-hmm. And so you have to get not only the agreement of knowing what they're doing, but mm-hmm. also the agreement of we believe this will work. Because if they don't believe it'll work, then you're already defeated.
Yeah. I feel like the, you know, kind of junk defense, it has nothing to do with the kids, but I made a mistake this past season with some junk defense. We got into our our last regular season game, and we were playing a really nice team, and they had two guards that could just really, really shoot. They just gave us fits. And we tried zone to start the game. They were shooting layups. They were dicing us up. We tried man the second quarter, and they hit some shots, and you're just like, what do we do? You know? And so we got it at halftime, and we were trying to hold off on the triangle and two until district play. And we're like, hey, we got to go. Let's try our triangle. And it worked. It won us that game. Kids did a great job. They did a great job. And then in our first district game, we played kind of a similar type of team that we had struggled. We had played them like 5 days before, and they had a really, really good point guard, and we played a lot of it in that game, and we ended up winning by 15, 16. If I had it to do over again, I probably would have tried to play that game more straight up. But our opponent in the district final, or the sub-district final, as we call it in Nebraska, now they had, you know, they saw the trend that we were going with. And the intention all along was to try and hold off on the triangle from using it heavily until that sub-district game. And I messed it up. You know, it wasn't the kids' fault. And when the kids ran it, we did a good job, or they did a good job of doing what we asked them to do. They did a great job with it. And we had a good team to run it with. But I kind of talking about the art of it. I still to this day kick myself in the tuchus for showing it too early as the season went along. But shoulda, coulda, woulda, you know, I don't know. You know, but that's a mistake that I made there. So, but that's what I got there for junk. Anything else on junk, Tony?
You know, it's just like you said, Marty. It's kind of like having, you know, multiple other pitches. It's the man to man can be your fastball, the zone can be your off speed pitch, and the junk, if you will, is that one with a lot of spin, your curveball, your slider, whatever the case may be. And I feel like you have to have it in your tool belt just to keep teams off, you know, kilter, not able to get comfortable. But I go back to what you started with. If you just have one, I think teams can figure you out, and you put your team in a little bit of a handicap situation there.
Coaches are absolutely loving our Taking Over a New Program booklet. As many of you know, I spent 2 years outside of coaching, and during that time, I hung a note card in my workspace at school that said, "Strip the house down to the studs." I took that time to really rethink and reorganize my thoughts on what it takes to run a transformational program. As I prepared for the possibility of coaching again, I organized these thoughts into this 96-page booklet. How much do I trust this booklet? I used this booklet as I went on interviews to help sell myself and my vision for what my new program would look like. If I'm using it to sell myself, why wouldn't I recommend it to you, my listeners? This booklet will help you look at any part of your program, no matter what stage you're at in your program, and help improve it in some way. It's all yours for only $15, which includes shipping and handling. For more information, email me at apenandanapkin@gmail.com. Well, Tony, you know who people have not been able to figure out for almost 40 years.
The rock band Europe.
And I won't say anything about Russian serial killers this week either. So, you know, we're good to go there. So, Tony, you have trivia this week. What do you have?
You know, in honor of Bill Walton, and may he rest in peace, I was watching a couple different clips on Bill Walton. I don't know if you saw the Mike Breen one on Twitter, X, whatever you call it. But that was a very, very powerful one. And then I was watching a couple other clips, one of him speaking about Coach Wooden and different things like that. And I ran across another one. And this is where my trivia question is going to come from.
Okay.
What Katy Perry music video did Bill Walton play a part in?
Wow. Oh, well, let me check my Katy Perry catalog. Last Friday Night.
Last Friday Night is definitely a Katy Perry song, but not the correct answer.
Roar.
Roar is another Katy Perry song and a good guess, but also not correct.
Okay, that's about the knowledge of Katy Perry songs that I have. Okay, what's that one? California girls are so raising tampadinis on top. Yeah, that one.
You keep singing like this, you're going to start to get some calls for American Idol and The Voice.
Hey, that goes back to my boy band days, you know. So
that one is not it either.
Yeah.
I thought you might get this one because it's a basketball podcast. Katy Perry has a song called Swish Swish. Bill Walton and Rich Eisen played the announcers in that video. But yes, and it was kind of a neat story because Bill was supposed to get picked up. His ride did not show up, so Rich Eisen offered him a ride to the hotel. And he's like, nah, I got this big chair, because he had this chair because of how bad his back and his health was. And so he's like, oh, I got a Tesla, it'll be okay. So he's got this car seat, he pushes that forward, puts the chair in, shuts the back hatch of the Tesla, and the chair catches the back windshield and cracks it. So as they're walking up, you hear this crack, and Bill's like, I am so sorry, Rich. And anyway, later on, Rich Eisen gets a note and a check from Bill Walton for $1,000 on this thing I was watching the other day with a tribute to Bill Walton. Rich Eisen still has that $1,000 check from Bill Walton. He never cashed it.
Oh, that's
so just kind of a neat Bill Walton story.
Yeah, well, you know, an icon without a doubt. You know, we're just young enough, not quite seasoned and experienced enough to remember Walton from his prime, and you know. I'm sure we'll get into it. You know, his prime was obviously very limited. It was a very limited time period. You know, the Bill Walton that I remember as a player was as a 12, 13-year-old kid watching the 85-86 Celtics and just watching. And again, your knowledge of the game at 12 is not nearly what it is at this stage, but you understand it. You could see the greatness and what he brought to the table with that 85-86 Celtics team. Did you hear the story about Walton celebrating the 86 championship? Did you hear that one?
No. Rick Carlisle shared a great story about when they were teammates and he was on a date with his going-to-be wife.
Yeah.
And Walton got him tickets to the Grateful Dead. That was an amazing one.
Yeah, so they win the championship, and you know that Celtics team, other than Danny Ainge, I think they hit it pretty hard, and so they're out, they're celebrating the championship. Larry Bird gets home at like 4 o'clock in the morning, and he's in bed. All of a sudden there's a knock at the door, and it's Walton, and he's got a bottle of booze, and Larry's like, Bill, it's time to go to bed. I'm tired. He's like, don't worry about me, Larry. I'll be here when you get up. You just go ahead and go to bed. And he went to bed. He woke up like 8 hours later, and Walton was still sitting in his kitchen sipping on this bottle of booze. It was just an honor and a privilege to play with you, you know. Do you ever see McHale do an imitation of Bill Walton?
I haven't seen that one.
Oh my gosh! I'll see if I can find it real quick. It is laugh out loud funny. But the outpouring. How tragic though is the Bill Walton story? Like, you know, how much was taken away from us from him as basketball fans? All of those things. You know, it is one of the saddest stories in sports history of what could have been in his career.
Yeah, and the thing that was kind of interesting in that whole story, I mean, here's a guy who could have been bitter and upset about the pro career he was robbed of, but you hear story after story. You know, Jay Billis, who we always called Jake, they had a great time together on the broadcast and stuff, shared a story about a guy that was a deadhead that was a friend of Jay Billis's. And so they called Walton when they were playing golf. And they just all had great stories about the notes that he would write and how generous he was. You know, whether it was Rick Carlisle and the Grateful Dead tickets. What if you haven't seen the Mike Breen story with his dad, make sure you have some tissues as you watch that thing. But that is an incredible story. I mean, he got him what they did for Mike Breen's dad. It was suffering from Parkinson's, and just how that was probably the highlight of his life at the, you know, towards the end of it, with Mike Breen's dad. And Mike Breen would say if anybody ever, you know, slandered Bill Walton, he was willing to fight him because of what he did for his dad. And then his brother was with him too on that trip in San Diego. But it's an incredible story.
Yeah. I think that, you know, you hear the stories, and there's some footage of him playing for 77 and 78, and as they, you know, a lot of people have said, you know, that 78 team was better than the 77 team that won the championship. And then Walton breaks his foot 60 games into the year, and that, you know, derailed his run, not only with the Blazers, but for the next 6 or 7 years of his career. And so you see that, you see the way that he played the game. I think you can make the argument that him and Lew Alcindor, later Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, were the two best college basketball players ever. They had the two best careers ever. Maybe you throw a Christian Laettner in there, but, you know, just the overall production, what they could have done, what they could have been. So I think that's I think probably the two careers that could have been, Bill Walton and Arvydas Sabonis, and both guys just ruined by their injury, their lower bodies. You know, with Walton it was his feet, with Arvydas it was his Achilles heels. He tore both of them, and this is long before. You know, the modern medicine that we have today. And I think what you saw in Walton, what we see with Nikola Jokic, is in many ways what we would have seen with Bill Walton in his career. I think that's a fair comp. I don't know. What do you think, Tony?
I think they're very, very similar. I think Jokic is maybe a little bit better at a few things than what Walton was, but Walton was by far the superior defender. I think Walton is a much superior defender, and then offensively, there are a few things that Jokic does, like bringing the ball up against pressure, that I don't think that Walton could have done. But I think that's a fairly similar comp. You know, you mentioned guys that had their careers, and you know, the what ifs. You know, Brandon Roy for the Blazers, and then Grant Hill with the Pistons, along with the two that you mentioned earlier. But yeah, I mean, Bill Walton, one of a kind. You know, there were times when I would listen to him announce, he'd drive me crazy because he, you know, you'd be going on these rants about different things that weren't basketball related. But him and Dave Pasch, probably about, I don't know, 5 years or so ago, I got to where I would just crack up laughing as I would listen to them do games. And, you know, I think if I remember correctly, Walton died, I think it was the day after the last Pac-12 game. Mm-hmm. I think they had the Pac-12 baseball championship, and then he passed the next day.
Yeah.
And the Celtics had won and made it to the finals too. So there was all kinds of like symmetry, if you will.
Yeah. I remember one time I was watching a game, and I think it was like when David Robinson and Hakeem Olajuwon were at their peak, and Olajuwon makes an Olajuwon-esque move, and he goes, Hakeem Olajuwon, footwork and hop and agility. That's the key to great post play right there. And then down on the other, no, it must have been Patrick Ewing, because he's, you know, Olajuwon, you know, footwork and agility, the key to any great post player. Then the next possession, the Knicks come right down, and they throw it into Ewing, and Ewing kind of, you know, bounces it 18 different times and throws it in something. power and strength. That's the key to great post play right there. I was like, well, what is it? You know, and Steve Snapper Jones like, what in the hell are you talking about? You know, that's a big part of it. So I think he was obviously in on the joke and he understood it. And I think that's what made him great. Do you ever watch the 4-part 30 for 30 on him, Tony?
I have not.
Oh, it is really, really good. And he always, and I think you might have said this earlier, I can't remember, but you know, he always called himself the luckiest man in the world. Mm-hmm. And just the attitude that he had, he could have been bitter, he could have been angry, and I'm sure they talked about he went through a time period where he was kind of really depressed and
stuff, suicidal. But,
yeah, and he found his way through it, and I think that's great. But I think one of the greatest things that Bill Walton could do or that he did do was he embraced everything, he loved every day, but he also had the ability to laugh at himself. So let's end our Bill Walton discussion here with this. Here's a clip of Frank Caliendo sitting right next to Bill Walton and Dave Pasch, and here's Frank Caliendo doing a Bill Walton impersonation.
Walton is here along with Bill Walton.
How great is this? Enjoying ourselves, enjoying the energy happening here inside the arena, outside the beautiful, the landscape that is Arizona, but inside, how loud can it? The look on your face, Bill, is that of utter frustration. Finally, some inspiration. The negativity that I have to fight every single moment. And now, someone here who can shine the light, someone who can appreciate the beauty of a saguaro, somebody who knows about the grandeur of the Sonoran Desert, somebody who knows that rivers can flow uphill. You never know when to talk when he's going, do you? You never know when there's going to be a break. He continues to go the entire time in the three. What was that three? I wasn't even looking. I wasn't paying attention to the game.
I wasn't either.
It was a two by Alonzo Verge.
Rest in peace, Bill Walton, and thank you for all that you've done for the game. Want to know more about A Pen and a Napkin and all the resources it offers? Go to apenandanapkin.com, a great resource for any coach at any level. In addition to our A Pen and a Napkin University video library options that are available to order, we have hundreds of pages of notes, from one-page handouts to book breakdowns to original coaching notes. We also have coaching links, a full catalog of every A Pen and a Napkin podcast, and ways to contribute to the growth of A Pen and a Napkin. apenandanapkin.com is a coaching resource that will help you become a better coach. All right, Tony, let's pick it up here. And of course, after all of that, our guy Mal Allen would say,
"How about that?"
So let's talk a little NBA playoffs here. I feel nothing is done until it's done. But we are taping on Thursday night. I'm looking on ESPN.com right now. The Mavericks are up 17 with about 4 minutes left to go in the second quarter. Again, not to say that the Timberwolves can't make a comeback, but I feel confident in saying that eventually at some point our matchup will be the Timberwolves and, or I'm sorry, not the Timberwolves, the Mavericks and the Celtics in the finals. We know it's going to be the Celtics. But let's say, for argument's sake, it's going to be the Mavericks against the Celtics. Tony, how are you feeling about this matchup as we start to size up? I don't know if we're going to have a chance to talk. Our next one, the finals start a week from tonight. So unless we decide to really stay up late, we won't have a chance to talk about anything until after the finals have started. So what are you thinking here, buddy?
You know, I'll state the obvious. The two teams are playing the best right now, and I go back to Dallas last year when they brought in Kyrie and didn't make the playoffs. Nobody was talking about how they needed to trade him and it was a bad move on their part and blah, blah, blah.
Yours truly included. I thought it was a terrible deal, but that was just me. So
it looks like, they're going to end up in the finals. And I think tonight's an important one for them to win just simply because of this reason. Boston swept Indiana. They're going to have rest. I'm assuming Porzingis will be back and they'll be able to implement him back into their lineup and stuff. And if you're Dallas, you don't want this thing to turn into a 6 or a 7 game thing and go into the finals, fatigued as you're getting ready to take on the Celtics. So I think this is an important one for Dallas to win tonight. But I will say this, I think Dallas is the favorite. And the reason why I state that is the fact that they have played much, much better competition than what Boston has. And that's no fault of Boston. Mm-hmm. But it seems like Boston, every team that they've gone against, has had serious injuries. You know, we mentioned Jimmy Butler with the Heat. And then you go and take a look with Donovan Mitchell and Jared Allen of the Cavaliers. And then towards the end of the series against Indiana, Tyrese Halliburton didn't play half that series, and they almost beat him without Halliburton. And so I just think that with who Dallas has played, the Clippers, the Thunder, and now the T-Wolves, I just think they're playing better.
As I sit here in my Boston Celtics shirt and my Boston Celtics hat, Tony, I am sitting here in this clothing.
I saw a picture of you today on Twitter.
I do believe that it is underestimated how much the Porzingis injury also affected Boston as well.
Mm-hmm.
Horford, instead of him playing 20 to 24 really good minutes, he's got to stretch himself out for at nights, 40 minutes. And that's a big shift, especially if you're a top-heavy team. Now, not to say that, again, not woe is me, you still have Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown, Derek White. I get it. Drew Holiday. I think that Porzingis injury, I think as these things happen, I think people have forgotten how important Porzingis was to the Celtics and how kind of with him in there, everybody kind of fits seamlessly into their roles, and into what they're really, really good at. So I think, and again, I was way off on the Minnesota Mavericks one. I thought the Timberwolves are going to win in 5.5 games, and they're probably going to lose in 5.5 games here. I think Boston is I think they're geared to win. I think it's going to be a really good series. I think Luka is playing very, very well, even with his bum knee. I think it's also important, if he could get a week off before the finals, I think that's going to help him out a lot. I think Kyrie is playing some of his best basketball, probably since, definitely his Cleveland days. And he's on that one, he's that 1B. Luka's 1A, he is the alpha. And sometimes the biggest thing one of the hardest things that players need to accept and embrace is their role. And I think Kyrie kind of always was ready to do that, but as long as it was on his terms. And I don't, the two guys that he's played with the best have been LeBron and Luka. And those guys are without a doubt alpha, alpha, alpha. You can't argue it. And I think that's the best situation for Kyrie. And he's played terrific. The double monster of Gafford and Lively have been really, really good. The role players, Exum, PJ Washington, Derrick Jones Jr. have played really well. But I just still think that the Celtics are just overall better. And I think at some point they're just going to really, people have said a lot of stuff. And then sometimes you do sit there and you're like, yeah, they deserve the criticism, but they are 12-2. They have won, I think it's 7 playoff games in a row, which is really, really hard to do. And again, I know it's been against teams that have been beat up a little bit. But I think with Porzingis back, I think everything will kind of fall back into place for them. And I think that it's going to be a really good series. I could see Boston winning it in about 6. That would be my prediction.
I think the series will go 6 or 7 for sure. Mm-hmm. And then I'm gonna ride with Dallas.
Mm-hmm. You're going to be Mavericky? You're going to go John McCain on us?
I'm going to go Mavericky. Little Tom Cruise, little John McCain.
Tom Cruise. Did you like the new Maverick movie?
I did. I wondered with there being that much time in between the two of them, because it wasn't like it was a 5-year turnaround or anything like that. It's like, is this even going to be good? But the crazy thing is I've heard because it did so well, that they've approved another one, and they should be getting ready to shoot it fairly soon.
I was just a wee lad of about 11 years old when I watched Top Gun in the theater, in the old Sheldon Theater in Sheldon, Iowa, before they converted it into the Pizza Ranch.
That's an upgrade.
Iowa Theater. It was kind of the first Cinedigm you could watch. You could eat food and watch a movie at the same time in a balcony. So ran a few pizza pies up those stairs over the years, working at the Pizza Ranch. But I remember Goose dying and brought a tear to this young tween's eye watching that happen. And we were watching Maverick, and they brought up Goose again. As you know, it's been 30 years since Goose died.
Yeah.
And you're still kind of like, I miss Goose. You know, it's like the guy's he's not even a real person. He's a fake movie character. But you know, I guess that kind of harkens back to your childhood there. And oops. And you know, it is what it is. So maybe we could go to Maverick Part 2 together, Tony.
We should. Yeah. We should, and do a podcast on it.
We could. And we
won't want to do it during it, though.
No, we might get in trouble. If we do, let's bring Ty Lue and let's have him pay for the Arby's that we'll be eating.
I like it. I like it. It sounds like a plan.
Yeah. What do you think of Ty Lue's contract? That's a lot of money for a guy that, you know, he's been a very good coach, but I don't think most folks would put him in with the Spoelstra, Popovich, Pat Riley type of level. But if you know, if you're Ballmer and you've got money to spend, it's not as big a deal to you. So, what do you think?
It's all about having all the cards. You know, we talked about knowing when to play cards with poker and junk defenses. And here's what I mean by that. They know LeBron loves him. Mm. The Lakers have an opening. And I don't think they wanted to see him walk across to the Lakers because that would make the Clippers look less than. And they already have that little brother complex, that inferiority complex, if you will. And because he had the leverage, Ballmer had to pony up. And so good for Ty Lue. You go through and take a look there. And I agree. I think he's a very, very good coach, but he's not in that upper tier, in my opinion. But he does a really, really good job. He's got a situation there in L.A., you know, with Russ and Paul George and Kawhi that he's got to kind of have a feathery, velvety touch with.
Yep. And With Ballmer's deep pockets, and it's Los Angeles, and they're moving into the new arena. They should be in contention on a fairly consistent basis. So let's say this doesn't exactly work out the way that they want it to with Harden and PG-13 and Kawhi, but I think that they can bounce back from that type of situation much faster than other franchises would be able to. Now, again, we have the new deal coming through, the new labor agreement, and I know there's different with the aprons and all that other stuff, but I think it is a good decision for him. I think it is the best coach available for the Clippers, and I think he, you know, yeah, he could pay for Arby's the next time we hang out. So thanks, T. Lou, for the curly fries the next time we hang out, buddy. So, Tony, episode 88, junk defense. A lot of really, really good stuff here. Anything you want to go home on, buddy?
I'm just so impressed that I got all the 88s tonight.
Yeah, you knocked that out of the park.
My own horn, but honk, honk.
Yeah. I'm kind of a big deal. I got all the number 88s right.
Next week with 89 could be a tough one for me.
I dare you to get off the phone and have that be the first thing you tell Rita.
She's coming out where I'm at here shortly, so I will. I'll let you know how it goes. I'm sure everybody will be waiting with bated breath to see how that goes.
I think you should tape it so we can put it out there.
If I do how, I might.
Oh, we just got an hour into it and we finally got stupid. So that's pretty good.
That's a record for us.
That's pretty good. So
we're maturing.
All right, episode 88, Jug Defenses. If you have any questions on anything, you know how to go hold of me and Tony. At Tony D. Viss, direct message, pen and a napkin, you know. You know the drill at this point. So coaches, I hope this has been helpful for you. As always, coaches, let's be sure to hone our craft one day.